Chapter 58. Buffeted. Omaha, summer to fall, 2003. In September, Buffett was in a state of high excitement. Fortune magazine had named him the most powerful person in business. To many oohs and ahs, he had recently auctioned his battered wallet with a stock tip inside for $210,000 to benefit Girls Incorporated, a nonprofit cause of Susie Junior's. Next, he had auctioned himself off on eBay, or rather, lunch for eight people with him, to benefit Glide Memorial Church in San Francisco, Susie's main cause. Glide gave HIV tests during services and held funerals and memorials for gay men whose families and churches had rejected them. The Reverend Cecil Williams' watchword was unconditional love, a term that Susie had adopted like a mantra, and even Warren now used from time to time. At Glide, everyone was welcome. Hookers, junkies, winos, drifters. According to the highest of 50 bidders on eBay, 2 hours of Buffett's time and a lunch for eight at Michael's were worth $250,100. That is, more than the stock tip in his wallet. Within days, an artist's rendering of him dressed in a toga as if descended from Mount Olympus would appear in Forbes to illustrate a list of best-dressed billionaires. However limited the competition for that list, although billionaires were becoming pretty commonplace these days, Buffett could never have been considered a contender for best-dressed anything were he not so celebrated and popular that pictures of him sold magazines. Not only that, the two Susies were scheduled to speak on philanthropy at Fortune's Most Powerful Women Summit the following week, at the beginning of October, before an audience made up of many of the most important women in America, including CEOs, entrepreneurs, and women of stature in many different fields. Buffett was elated at this coronation of his wife and daughter, particularly that they would be making the presentation together. On the Friday afternoon before the conference began, Susie called Warren to tell him that she was going to be arriving a day late because on Monday she was having a biopsy. She had seen her periodontist in June, an appointment that had been delayed from May by her earlier bowel obstructions, esophageal ulcer, and anemia. The periodontist had found some pin-dot-sized spots on the floor of her mouth and referred her to a specialist. 2 months had passed as Susie tried to work around the specialist's schedule and her own complicated travel itinerary to arrange an appointment. Once the appointment was finally booked, she had almost canceled it in favor of a visit to the Gates Foundation. "No, no, 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 you're not canceling," said Kathleen Cole. It was rare for Cole to contradict her friend and boss outright, but now she insisted, "You have to go." At the appointment, Dr. Deborah Greenspan had felt around Susie's neck and found swollen lymph nodes on one side. She insisted that Susie see yet another specialist, Dr. Brian Schmidt, the following Monday for a biopsy. Susie seemed unconcerned about the biopsy. She wanted to delay it in order to avoid missing any of the Fortune conference. "I have to do this," she told Kathleen, referring to her appearance there. The specialist, Dr. Schmidt, refused to postpone the procedure, however. Buffett absorbed the news quietly, but was deeply shaken. A few hours after Susie called, he carried on a long, rambling phone conversation with someone else, filling the unrelenting minutes after he got home from work. Seconds before his bridge game was due to begin, he said casually, but in a low, serious voice, "Oh, by the way, Susie's having a biopsy on Monday." "For what?" asked his shocked listener. "Some kind of thing in her mouth," he said. "Well, I'll talk to you later." Then he hung up. Susie had the biopsy. She went and spoke at the conference, then flew east to Decatur to visit Howie on the farm, see her grandkids, and ride on the combine for the harvest before returning to San Francisco. With hindsight, Howie would think to himself, "Gee, she'd always talked about coming out for the harvest, but she'd never done it before." At the time, however, he noticed nothing unusual, for she behaved as she always did. Warren kept his face glued to the computer screen, whether surfing the news or playing bridge or helicopter. His rising anxiety showed in the usual manner. He repeated the same questions and statements about a subject over and over, while denying, if asked, that he was concerned. On Friday, Susie and Kathleen Cole went to USC Medical Center to learn the biopsy results. Susie continued to seem oblivious to the potential seriousness of the situation. When they arrived at Dr. Schmidt's office, Susie said to Kathleen, "You're so nervous. Why are you so nervous?" Kathleen thought, "Oh my gosh, doesn't she get that this could be bad news?" When they met with the doctor, he told Susie that she had stage 3 oral cancer. She was stunned by the diagnosis. "It was like somebody shot a thunderbolt through her," says Cole. She'd apparently not even considered this as a possibility. Susie had her moment of tears. Then, characteristically, by the time they got into the car, she had pulled herself together and started chicken souping everybody but herself. She called Warren. He did not say much. She called Susie Jr. and told her, "Call your dad. He's going to be a mess." Then she went home and talked to Warren again, and to Susie Jr., Howie, and Peter. By then, Susie Jr. had already gone to the internet to research. She called her father and said, "Don't read the oral cancer website." Oral cancer strikes only 34,000 people a year, but kills more than 8,000. An often painless but fast-growing cancer, it is more deadly than melanoma, brain cancer, liver cancer, cervical cancer, or Hodgkin's disease. It is particularly dangerous because it's usually discovered only after it has spread to the lymph nodes of the neck, at which point the primary tumor may have invaded surrounding tissue and potentially migrated to other organs. A person with oral cancer has an especially high risk of developing a second primary tumor. Surviving a first bout with the disease carries a 20-fold greater risk of recurrence. At least 90% of those diagnosed with oral cancer are long-time smokers or use smokeless tobacco. Alcohol use combined with smoking raises the risk even more. Susie Buffett never smoked or drank. She had no significant risk factors. The fact that her cancer was stage 3 meant that it had already spread to at least one lymph node, but probably not to more distant sites. Susie returned to her apartment overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge, every wall covered with a souvenir of a trip, a gift from a friend, or a piece of art that meant something to her. The woman who never let go of anything or anybody started telling people, "I've had a wonderful life. My kids are grown. I've lived to see my grandkids. I love my life. But I've done my job, and I'm not really needed anymore." "If it were up to me," she told Kathleen, "I would go off to a villa in Italy in privacy and just die." She was far more fearful of a protracted, painful death than of dying itself. But if she simply gave up, she would be abandoning people who were important to her, people who had been part of her life for decades. It was really Warren for whom she was going to have the surgery. However, she told Kathleen and her friend Ron Parks, among others, that she hadn't decided whether to do the follow-up radiation that was a standard part of the treatment to reduce the risk of a recurrence, which was high. For some reason, perhaps because she was in a state of shock, she didn't seem to grasp how important it was. The following morning, as she and Kathleen were making plans for what was to come, Susie unaccountably refused to authorize Kathleen to pay for the equipment that would be needed to make her apartment accessible post-surgery. Kathleen needed to get elevator chairs to carry her up all the flights of stairs to her apartment at the top of the building. Susie would not hear of it. Kathleen decided that Susie was in some kind of shock or denial and finally called Susie Jr., who simply said to ignore her mother and make the necessary arrangements. Meanwhile, a stunned Warren paced through his routine, as he invariably did in a crisis. He escorted a very upset Astrid to the Nebraska football game in Lincoln. He flew out to San Francisco the following morning, where he learned that Susie needed major surgery within the next few weeks. She had a 50% chance of surviving for 5 years. A large portion of her jaw and most or all of her teeth might be removed. For more than a month after the surgery, she would be fed through a tube in her nose that led directly into her stomach. She would not be able to talk during that period, and the surgery was potentially disfiguring. Susie told Warren little more. She did say she was worried that she would frighten her own grandchildren. They decided she would fly to New York City for a second opinion at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center the following week, although this was largely a formality. Once back in Omaha, Warren filled his every conscious moment with phone conversations, internet bridge games, work, and strategizing how to handle an upcoming meeting with Karen Elliott House, publisher of the Wall Street Journal. Buffett by now had had several run-ins with the Journal over its coverage of him, beginning with a 1992 story that called him a tough, polished man beneath the mask of a folksy sage. House was arriving, perhaps on a repair mission, perhaps to sound him out about buying the financially troubled paper. But his mind never really left Susie. He touched on her in brief cloudbursts of conversation. He had decided to spend every weekend in San Francisco with her during the coming months. Although he didn't really know what he was letting himself in for, he wanted to give her, in some fashion, what he knew she would have given him had their situations been reversed. He felt certain, he said, she needed his presence. For sure, he was going to need hers. The meeting with House proved uneventful. Nobody got strangled, nor did Buffett buy the paper. For the rest of the week, he started every morning in a thunderhead mood, a sure sign that he was not sleeping well, then brightened through the course of the day. Other than Debbie Bosanek and a few other people, nobody at Berkshire Hathaway headquarters knew the reason. During that week, he rarely left his corner of the floor next to the Xerox room and the two file rooms, spending much of his time on the phone with Susie. Although they talked for hours, she was vague about the ordeal that she faced. Initially, she herself had not grasped the extensiveness of the surgery, which might also involve a bone graft taken from her leg. The surgeons were not sure how much of her face would be involved, although they thought they could spare her tongue. Most devastating to her was that she would probably not be able to sing again. She had discussed the surgery with her former son-in-law, Alan Greenberg, who had a long-time familiarity with her medical problems, having taken his friend, boss, and former mother-in-law to the emergency room several times over the years. Sensitive to the way Buffett recoiled at anything to do with illness, Greenberg did not even mention Susie when he went to Buffett's office to update him on the Foundation's projects. Yet while Warren didn't want to know much, he talked and talked about what he did know. They've got a team of five guys, and it's at least a 10-hour deal. She's got the best care in the world. She got a letter from Howie that... no mother could get a better letter. She's got a lot going for her, but it'll be a tough ordeal. They've given her a lot of information, and she knows I don't want the details. She's told me what she thinks I can handle. I'm sure the doctors think it's crazy that I'm not talking to them directly, but I can't take that, so she's sort of told me the key elements. A few days later, Susie flew into Omaha to pick up Susie Jr., who was going to accompany her to Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York for her second opinion. Tests there gave them the good news that there was no indication that the cancer had spread, and they flew back to Omaha, where Big Susie was going to spend the weekend. But while there, she had another episode of crippling pain from her abdominal adhesions. This attack, coming less than 5 months after the obstruction that had prevented the Buffetts from traveling to Africa the previous May, was disturbing. She had to stay over at Susie Jr.'s, but for once, heavy doses of painkillers enabled her to avoid hospitalization, which had always been required before. Haggard and pasty-faced, Buffett dragged himself to the office, then left in the middle of the week for a Coca-Cola board meeting in Atlanta. By the time he returned, Susie had begun to recover and went to pay a visit to Astrid. When she saw Susie, Astrid simply broke down in sobs and, once again, it was Susie's turn to comfort someone else. After the weekend, when Susie flew back to San Francisco, Buffett's mood turned dark again. His voice went gravelly, and he was clearly having trouble sleeping. The biennial Buffett group meeting, which was being held a few days later, weighed on his mind. Susie's doctors didn't want her to travel to the meeting, which was taking place in San Diego. Thus, for the first time since 1969, Warren would be going alone. Not only would Susie not be there, but his friend Larry Tisch, an early partner and the head of Lowe's Corporation, also would be absent, because he was too ill with advanced stomach cancer to attend. Buffett was obviously preoccupied with thoughts of what it would be like to go to this meeting without Susie. News of her illness was sure to cause a stir, simply because many of the people attending were finding out about it shortly before the meeting. For 5 days, he was going to have to answer questions about her, accept sympathy, and keep his emotions in check. He would have to perform his role of master of ceremonies, maintaining interest in what was going on without striking any false notes of excessive good cheer. Buffett had mastered the art of compartmentalizing to such a degree that these skills were second nature to him, but under the circumstances, it was still going to be a hell of a performance. Once he was back in his hotel room at the end of the evening, he would be alone in the dark with his thoughts and his dreams. "I dream a lot," he said the day before leaving for San Diego, and the dreams could be disturbing. "I have a multiplex going on in there. It's a full-time occupation." That evening he ordered a club sandwich for dinner and ate with a visitor in his office, wanting to fill the time until Sharon took over to distract him with a bridge game, then conversation till all hours. Now he sat talking, at first struggling through a brittle discussion about business and politics. Eventually, the conversation wound its way to what had been bubbling beneath the surface for days, the surgery that would take place shortly after the meeting ended. For the briefest fraction of a second, a look of surprise flickered across his face. Then his face began to crumple and collapsed into his hands. His shoulders heaved and rocked, and he slid forward in his chair like a tower crumbling in an earthquake. Dry, desolate, heaving sobs, like silent screams, came gasping out of him. There wasn't any consolation for this. Gradually, the racking sobs spent themselves. Then he began to talk about Susie. He cried quietly, off and on, for about 2 hours. He was afraid of what she was going to have to suffer through. She was stronger than he. His main concern was the pain she would face. He was even more worried that she might accept death as a natural thing and not fight it as he would. He was terrified of losing her. Assumptions that were part of the very core of his being had been upended. He had always assumed that he would never be alone because she would outlive him. He had always assumed that he could count on her wisdom and judgment to handle any life and death decisions that might have to be made. He had always assumed that she would run the foundation after he was gone. She would keep peace within the family if he was not there. She would see to it that Astrid was taken care of. She would resolve any conflicts, soothe any bad feelings. She would handle his funeral and shape the way in which everyone would remember him. Above all, he had been counting on Susie to be there for him at the end, to sit beside him and hold his hand and calm his terror and ease his suffering when death was approaching, just as she had done for so many others. For the first time, he had to contemplate that it might not work out this way. But these thoughts were so unbearable that he could only glance at them before shutting them down. He was sure that her doctors would take care of her and that she would live. By the time he left the office for his bridge game, he was in a somber mood, but calm and collected. The next morning, he flew to San Diego. At the Buffett Group conference, he struck people as subdued but not despondent. He presided over 3 days of meetings that included a dinner at the Gates House, a talk by Bill Ruane about his project to improve the schools in Harlem, Jack Byrne on management succession, and Charlie Munger on the life of Andrew Carnegie, the great industrialist who had maintained that he who dies rich dies disgraced. Howie Buffett dropped in to describe the motivations behind the photographs in his book, Tapestry of Life, which showed scenes of human suffering in impoverished Africa. Jeffrey Cohen, dean of the Annenberg School for Communications at USC, gave a speech entitled, From Young Idealists to Old Bureaucrats, about the aging of the so-called Silent Generation, those born in the 1930s and early 40s, which comprised most of those who were in the room. While Warren was in San Diego, Astrid was at the Canyon Ranch Spa in Tucson, where he had sent her because she was so upset about Susie that he wanted her to get away to a place where she might be able to relax. She had never been to a spa before and resisted at first. Pampering herself at a swanky hacienda was like attempting a triple Lutz to a woman who had never so much as treated herself to a pedicure. Astrid had no vanity whatsoever. She packed just a few T-shirts for her week at the famous resort. Handed a turkey wrap for lunch on arrival, out of habit she began to badger the staff about recycling and styrofoam packaging. At the reception area, a nurse took her into a small office to design a spa and wellness regime for her. When asked how she was feeling and what concerns she had, Astrid replied that her concern was her friend Susie. The nurse apparently recognized that she was dealing with one of those women who focus on everybody else at the expense of their own needs. Gently, she steered Astrid toward relaxing treatments, like healing touch. Astrid took a couple of yoga classes, went on a bird walk, took some cooking classes, got a facial, had a couple of massages, and learned some golf. She groused about being taken care of, but, to her surprise, managed to survive it and found that some aspects of it were not so terrible. Buffett flew from the meeting in San Diego to San Francisco the day before Susie's surgery. He had been scheduled to attend a NetJets marketing event that day and had made up his mind to go, but Susie Jr., who recognized this as a form of denial, told him he must come to San Francisco instead. Reluctantly, therefore, he joined the family for dinner at Susie's apartment. Everyone behaved in character. Since Susie had no one to care for but herself, she avoided discussing her feelings about the next day's surgery with the family and busied herself talking on the phone. Warren spent much of the evening playing helicopter, with his eyes leashed to the computer. Very early the next morning, the family accompanied Susie to the University of California San Francisco Medical Center, where the technicians hooked her up to an IV and drew a huge oval from her knee to her left ankle with a magic marker. This, they said, was to indicate the area where they were going to open her leg to take out what they needed for the bone graft. Dr. Isley, Susie's surgeon, came by to tell them that he would leave the operating room after 90 minutes or so to let them know for sure whether the cancer had spread. Then Susie took her daughter into the bathroom and shut the door behind them. She didn't want Warren to hear what she had to say. "Listen," she said, "he is a wuss. You need to understand that if they get in there and there's more cancer, don't let them operate. I'm so afraid he's going to tell them to operate even if it's really widespread, because he won't want me to die." By 8 a.m., Susie was in surgery, and the family went to the main surgical lounge where they awaited word, along with all the other people who were passing the time watching Jerry Springer on television while their loved ones were in the O.R. Warren pretended to read the newspaper. From time to time, he closed the paper, held it up before his face, reached a hand behind to wipe tears from his eyes, then opened it again. Dr. Isley returned only 45 minutes later. Although he had found cancer in two lymph nodes, it had not spread from there, which was good news. The surgery would remove only the lower floor of her mouth, the inside of her cheek, and about a third of her tongue. She did not need a bone graft. After Dr. Isley left, Warren began to ask, "Well, now, Suze, was that what he said would take an hour and a half, or is he going to come back out again? Are you sure? Will they really know?" Each time, Susie Jr. reassured him that they already had the answer, and each time he would wait a few minutes and ask her again. "Well, how did they know so fast?" he kept saying. "I don't think this is good. Maybe he's going to come back out." 16 hours later, Susie was in the intensive care unit, breathing through a tracheotomy tube. Her left arm was bandaged from wrist to elbow, where the surgeons had carved a slice of flesh for the skin graft inside her mouth. Because her tongue was swollen out of her mouth, a feeding tube had been threaded through her nose into her stomach. She coughed continually, clogging the trach tube, which had to be cleared frequently so that she could breathe. The next morning at the hospital, Susie Jr. told her father, "You need to get really ready for this. It's a shocking thing to see." Warren steeled himself as he walked into Susie's room. He knew he could not allow her to see any spasm on his face that would reveal to Susie how ghastly she appeared. Making a huge effort of will, he managed to sit unflinching with her for a little while. Then Susie Jr. told him and her brothers that they could go home. There was nothing further they could do. Having stuffed his feelings into a Pandora's box while he remained at Susie's bedside, after he left, he says he spent 2 days just crying, basically. He went back to San Francisco for the following 2 weekends. Then, just before Susie was going to leave the hospital and go home, he flew down to Georgia and spoke to a group of students at Georgia Tech. He didn't talk about business much, but he invoked many of his familiar themes. He told them the fable of the genie, and he talked about philanthropy. He said the best investment they could make in life was in themselves. He told them about his hero, Ben Graham, and said to choose their heroes carefully, because heroes matter in your life. He told them to work for people they admired. They asked him what had been his greatest success and greatest failure. He didn't tell them about his business mistakes of omission this time. Instead, he said, "Basically, when you get to my age, you'll really measure your success in life by how many of the people you want to have love you actually do love you. I know people who have a lot of money, and they get testimonial dinners, and they get hospital wings named after them, but the truth is that nobody in the world loves them. If you get to my age in life and nobody thinks well of you, I don't care how big your bank account is, your life is a disaster. That's the ultimate test of how you have lived your life. The trouble with love is that you can't buy it. You can buy sex, you can buy testimonial dinners, you can buy pamphlets that say how wonderful you are. But the only way to get love is to be lovable. It's very irritating if you have a lot of money. You'd like to think you could write a check. I'll buy $1 million worth of love. But it doesn't work that way. The more you give love away, the more you get." Warren continued visiting every weekend after Susie went home to her sunshine-filled apartment overlooking San Francisco Bay. The egg-yolk yellow rugs were gone, lest their dust clog the trach tube. Chair elevators carried her up the 4 flights of stairs. The nurses used a rented suction tracheotomy system. The doctors began to prepare Susie for the 6-week course of radiation, which was intended to kill any remaining cancer cells. It would begin in December and continue through the holidays. The radiation, which she had never quite agreed to in the first place, was going to burn her throat. The doctors had told her to bulk up before the surgery because she could expect to lose around 50 pounds over the entire course of the surgery and radiation. That was a lot of weight, but one of the thoughts that had comforted her before the surgery was that she could afford to lose a good bit of it. Now, as the feeding tube came out, the nurses began to feed Susie 6 units of liquid meal replacement a day. It took her much of the day to get it down because of the pain. Under stress, Warren had gained a little weight. He felt that he needed to lose 20 pounds and had decided to diet alongside Susie's liquid meal regimen. "That can't be a lot of fun," he said, "so I won't have any fun either." Buffett's manner of dieting was as eccentric and unhealthy as the rest of his eating habits. He decided to stick with his usual approach, which was to consume only 1,000 calories a day and budget it however he liked. That meant he could spend the 1,000 calories on licorice, peanut brittle, hamburgers, or whatever else he wanted to eat, so long as he didn't exceed the self-imposed limit. The easiest step was to cut back on all the cherry Coke, replacing it with nothing and thereby dehydrating himself. The idea behind the 1,000-calorie starvation regimen was to get the pain of dieting over with fast. He was impatient and cut off debate over the health merits of such a diet. "At my height and age," he said, "I reckon that I can eat about 1,000,000 calories a year and maintain my weight." The nice, round, even number of 1,000,000 calories pleased him. "I can spend those calories however I want. If I want to eat a bunch of hot fudge sundaes in January and starve the rest of the year, I can do that." It was completely rational on the surface, yet totally ludicrous. But since he had never been either seriously overweight or seriously ill, it was pointless to argue with him. He went on this crash diet every year right before the shareholder meeting. It is possible, however, that all that dehydration may have had nothing to do with his earlier kidney stone. Regardless, Buffett had a way of winning arguments before they ever occurred. The one extremely rare exception was when he argued with the press over how it presented him. He never sparred with the Financial Times or the New York Times, both of which he read religiously. His problem always was the Wall Street Journal. Through the years, his penchant for letting the rubes in on the fact that Wall Street was a sort of speakeasy inhabited by people who were out to fleece them had made trafficking with the Journal, Wall Street's official broadsheet, dangerously fraught. He had once done an editorial board luncheon at the Journal that backfired on him. Editorial board meetings were an opportunity for Buffett to put on his teaching hat and explain the economic issues of the day to editors, something he relished. But this time, an off-the-record quote had shown up in the paper. Kay Graham's rule of journalism had tripped him up, Graham's maxim being that a statement given off the record meant the quote will not be used, unless it is really good. Buffett had been furious and obtained excuses and apologies from the Journal over its betrayal, which could not be undone. Moreover, the Journal's editorial page poured vitriol on him periodically because he supported shifting the tax burden away from the poor and middle class and toward the rich. He would not dream, however, of skipping a day of reading the Journal, even on Fridays, the day he drove out to Epley Airfield for the 3-hour NetJet flight to San Francisco. Sharon Osbourg picked him up at the airport and took him straight to Susie's apartment in Pacific Heights. Not wanting to disturb her or to be awakened by the light that came in through Susie's huge, uncurtained windows, he slept down in the ground-floor apartment that Susie used mainly for storage. While Susie napped and slept, he went to Sharon's much of the time to watch football on TV and cry on her shoulder. Sometimes they went to midnight movies. When Warren was in town, Susie saw no visitors, only her daughter, her nurses, and a couple of people like Kathleen who were caring for her day to day. Nearly everyone, even Jeannie Lipsy Rosenblum and Warren's sister Bertie, who had bought apartments in the same building, were kept away all the time, not just during the weekends, the feeling being that even a soupçon of attention would be too draining for Susie. Every day Jeannie wrote Susie a card and left it downstairs for her. Like many of Susie's loved ones, Bertie was sad about not being able to see her sister-in-law. She had always looked up to Susie for her wisdom about people, and now, in the wake of her husband's recent death, she felt that she had gained a similar wisdom herself. Hilt was a psychologist, she says, and even without trying, he could see what people's meta-message was. When Hilt died, what he willed to me was that I can see things about people that I never saw before. All of a sudden, my eyes opened about things I had never understood. Bertie felt that now her relationship with Susie would be different, more equal, so that she would no longer have to lean on Susie. She also felt she was starting to understand Susie for the first time. As her brother traveled back and forth to San Francisco every week, he too was learning about things he had never known before. Medication, radiation, and the ins and outs of dealing with doctors and nurses and hospital equipment. And he was also exploring a new emotional territory, facing Susie's fears as well as his own. When talking about this new world he had just entered, he measured out his words, keeping his feelings private, adjusting how much he shared according to how well he knew his audience. Sometimes he used as a distraction a favorite prop, Arnold Schwarzenegger, a fellow elephant friend whom he had recently endorsed as the Republican candidate in a recall election to unseat Gray Davis, the governor of California. "My wife had an operation in San Francisco about 6 weeks ago, and I'll be out there a couple of days every week." Pause. "Well, you know, Arnold, sometimes people can't tell which one is which when we're next to each other. When we're stripped down, nobody has a chance." When someone he knew better called, he struggled to talk about a subject that formerly he would have avoided at all costs. "Oh, hi, Chuck. Yeah. Well, she's doing better in every respect than people have told us would be the case going in. She doesn't have any energy, and it's been an experience like she hasn't had before. But in terms of her mouth healing, in terms of swallowing, everything, it's all going fine. And the people are terrific. Not a lot of pain right now. I think it's psychological more than, I mean, she's not finding life any fun at all at the moment, but the annual meeting? Well, I would say this. Now, with Susie's condition the way it is, I think we're going to skip the music and just, there's no way she'll be singing in this May's meeting, so let's see what happens next year." From time to time, he still talked about Susie being able to sing again, even though that wasn't going to happen. And only with people with whom he was very close, such as his daughter, would he drop the occasional hint that he needed help. "Hello? Hi, I feel fine. I'm getting 2 hours of sleep every night." "Oh, great. Why don't you come down and swap cars with me? Oh, yeah, there's a ham to pick up, incidentally, too. It's here." "We will. Maybe tomorrow or something. Okay. Okay? Okay." 2 hours sleep a night. If I'm thinking about something, I'm not going to sleep. I slept 2 hours last night, actually, and I feel fine. It doesn't kill me not to sleep. Susie's going through this thing again about whether she wants the radiation. We'll get over it. Her inclination over this was going in a worse direction when I left San Francisco, but it's still better than it was when I got there, so... The only good thing about Susie having the operation is that this is the first year in 30-odd years that I won't go to Emerald Bay for Christmas. I'm not even sure my house is there anymore.
Chapter 59. Winter. Omaha and San Francisco, December 2003 to January 2004. Susie was still resisting the idea of radiation, so anxious about it that she was taking a lot of Ativan. And Dr. Islay started giving me little Ativan speeches, said Susie Jr., about how I needed to stop asking for so much Ativan for her. But she was very agitated about the radiation. Warren's view was that it was a form of handicapping. If radiation improved your odds, why not do it? The surgery, he told her, was the hard part. The radiation wouldn't be nearly as hard. But the radiation oncologist had told Susie, if anyone tells you about their radiation and says it's not that bad, don't believe them. Radiation in your mouth is not like any other radiation. Everything will taste like metal. Your whole mouth will be burned. Your salivary glands will be damaged or destroyed. You may lose all your taste buds. There will be a lot of pain. Susie already had a lot of pain. She felt she had the right to refuse more pain. She's seen a lot of people die, seen people go through more than they needed to go through. We both want control over the end of life. She has no fear of death, but somehow she got the idea that by having radiation, she would lose control and that radiation would increase the chances of a terrible end. We went on for hours and hours, around and around. It's up to her to decide what to do. But on the other hand, nothing makes sense right now. She keeps saying, I know my brain isn't working right. And she's had these two doctors prepare her for a sort of worst-case scenario, in the nicest way, but just because they'd rather do it that way. To calm her anxiety, every night she went through a bedtime ritual centered around a song by the singer Bono, who had befriended Susie Jr. after meeting Warren at a NetJets event. Now Susie put on U2's Rattle and Hum DVD when she was going to bed and fell asleep to All I Want Is You. All the promises we break, from the cradle to the grave, when all I want is you. At the NetJets event, Bono had initiated his connection to the Buffetts when he told Warren that he just wanted 15 minutes of his time. I knew nothing of Bono to speak of, so he asked me a few questions, and for some reason we hit it off. When I gave him an idea and he liked it, he'd say, "That's a melody." And at the end he said, "I can't believe it. 4 melodies in 15 minutes. I love music. But actually, U2's music doesn't blow me away. What interests me is that Bono splits the revenue of U2 among 4 people absolutely equally. Buffett could at times be brutally rational about the way vast sums of money made a person more attractive, funny, and intelligent. Still, his wonderment had never quite ceased that celebrities of any rank sought him out. No matter how cool he tried to play it, he was flattered that no less a personage than Bono had deemed him smart. When Bono came out to Omaha during his Heartland of America tour, he contacted Buffett and through him met Susie Jr. Still a rock and roll girl at heart, Susie Jr. in turn was flattered and captivated by the singer's interest in her. The soulful leader of what some considered the biggest rock band on earth, he had a romantic hipster nobility that appealed to both her and her mother. U2's music spoke of a spiritual longing for love and peace. Their message, the more you take, the less you feel, you gotta give it away, was exactly the kind of thing both Susies would respond to. He invited Susie Jr. to join the board of his charitable operation, DATA, Debt, AIDS, Trade, Africa, and he had made a huge impression on Susie's children, too. He was just terrific with my grandkids, Susie's kids, Emily and Michael. He talked to Emily and had an enormous effect on her. Bono had invited Emily to work as an intern at DATA the following summer. Big Susie, however, had never met her granddaughter's rock star boss. She seemed to feel that she had finished her own personal mission on Earth. "Why can't I just lie in bed the rest of my life?" she said, "and the grandchildren can come out and it will be fine." "Is she kidding?" thought Susie Jr. "This is not going to happen. You have to get up," she told her mother. "You can't just lie in bed the rest of your life. You'll do the radiation and you'll get better and you'll be able to travel again." Big Susie looked surprised. "Do you really think so?" she asked. Finally, Susie was persuaded to go through with the radiation. She went in to be measured for the mask that the radiologist had to construct to cover her face so that the radiation could be safely applied. Buffett was now involving himself more and more in the details of his wife's treatment. "I'm just nuts about her radiologist, who designs the mask and the angle of attack. She shows me on her computer exactly what gets hit from every angle, where the tongue and the vocal cords are." Some of Susie's friends questioned whether she was once again doing something to please everybody else instead of making her own choices. Nevertheless, she had agreed to 33 treatments, 5 treatments a week, with weekends off, beginning in mid-December. Since the doctors had stressed the importance of continuous radiation, the rational Buffett ruminated over the fact that the off days happened to coincide with weekends. He thought it awfully convenient for the doctors and wondered whether his wife's health was being compromised. A week after the first treatments began, he flew to Buffalo to announce a new $40 million Geico service center the company was going to open near Buffalo to manage its rapid expansion, holding a news conference with New York Governor George Pataki. The new center would bring 2,000 or more jobs to the state, replacing some of the 17,700 jobs the Buffalo-Niagara region had lost in the past 3 years. Buffett Carnegieized Buffalo, a city chosen for its smart, friendly people. From there, he headed out to San Francisco for Christmas, which occurred during the first 2 weeks of Susie's radiation. For the first time since the 1970s, she was not going to be with her children and grandchildren over the holidays. But she wanted everyone else to be together for Christmas, so the rest of the family gathered at Susie Jr.'s in Omaha, while Warren and Susie spent the time together in San Francisco. For Christmas, Warren and Susie gave each of the kids another 600 shares of Berkshire stock for their foundations, a complete surprise which thrilled all of them. Howie had donated most of his money so far to wildlife and environmental causes, Susie Jr. to education and local causes in Omaha, and Peter to environmental, Native American, and local causes in Wisconsin. With an eye to the future, knowing that they would one day have much larger sums of money to distribute, their parents had decided to give them this gift to train them in philanthropy. Within 2 years of Warren or Susie's death, $30, $40, $50 billion or more, depending on Berkshire's stock price at the time, would sluice into the foundation, and the law required that shortly thereafter the foundation begin giving away 5% each year. Buffett did not believe in perpetual foundations that entrusted money to the whims of future generations of trustees, but with only a couple of employees, the Buffett Foundation was woefully ill-equipped to ramp up fast enough to give away $1 billion a year. Warren had been giving this problem a lot of thought, and it occurred to him that one way Susie could choose to deal with it was to turn some of the Buffett Foundation money over to the Gates Foundation. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation had grown since its establishment in 2000 to a multi-billion-dollar philanthropy. Gates said that 4.2 billion people in the world, most of the Earth's population, made less than $2 a day. Yet each of their lives was worth as much as any American's. These people lived in the here and now, not in some generation far in the future. "Bill Gates is the most rational guy around in terms of his foundation. He and Melinda are saving more lives in terms of dollars spent than anybody else. They've worked enormously hard on it. He thinks extremely well. He reads thousands of pages a year on philanthropy and health care. You couldn't have two better people running things. They have done incredible work. They've thought it through. Their values are right. Their logic is right." Warren was still assuming that Susie ultimately would be the one to make these decisions, however. "Susie gets all the money, and she is in total charge of everything. My will just gives it to her, and her will just gives it to me. It's crazy to try and write complicated instruments. You don't need to do it. Now she could give it all to my kids' foundations if she wants. She is not restricted. But Susie doesn't care whether she has one share of Berkshire or 100,000 shares of Berkshire. She will probably just put it all in the foundation. Not a share needs to be sold. In the first year or two, while they were ramping up on other things, if they just matched what the Gateses did and gave them $2 billion instead of $1 billion a year, that'd be perfectly appropriate. Don't get proprietary about it. I'm perfectly willing to let other people do all the work at Berkshire, but they would hate that at the Buffett Foundation. It seems so lacking in imagination and innovativeness, even though it's terribly logical. Now, that isn't what people want to do. I mean, the normal human institution reacts enormously against that. But that is not a crazy system. It's like doubling your position on a stock. He's got people in place, and if we gave some money to him, the last half of the money would be used as intelligently as the first half. There would be very little fall-off in utility of the last dollar versus the first dollar. Giving money to other foundations, it's just not what foundations like to do. But there's nothing wrong with copying good people. Coattailing by giving some of the money to the Gates Foundation while the Buffett Foundation was ramping up to give away its tens of billions might be completely logical. What wasn't completely logical, given the current circumstances, was for Warren to assume that Susie would be the one making these decisions, rather than himself or his daughter, and to operate under this scenario without a backup plan. Although maybe he was starting to have the embryo of a backup plan. Over the holidays, Susie grew despondent again about her radiation. She threatened to discontinue it. Buffett went through another stretch of spending hours and hours convincing her that she had gone this far, and it didn't make sense to stop. No matter what Susie decided, however, the radiation schedule would have two interruptions, at Christmas and New Year's. Warren steamed. It bothers me that they take off for the holidays as well as weekends. She's had 8 radiation treatments. It just doesn't seem right. And the radiologist acknowledged to me that dropping the schedule to 4 days a week is somewhat marginal. Susie was still not well enough to receive any new visitors. Neither of her sons had even seen their mother since the surgery. But Howie, his wife Devon, and their son Howie B. finally joined Warren in San Francisco for a couple of days. Howie, still a one-man chorus line of rockettes when it came to energy, saw Susie just a touch. But the family was still not allowing other people to visit. She'd just as soon conserve her strength as see anybody. Frankly, there's a number of people that are just dying to get at her. Some of them she's a huge crutch for, and all they'll do is drain her if they get close, because she can't stop being their resident psychiatrist or professor or whatever. She feels a little safer when I'm there, but she knows that if she starts seeing other people, they'll basically try to draw energy from her. With me or with little Sue's, she doesn't feel that way. But even with my sister or her best friend Bella, she can't help but go back into the mode where she's giving and they're receiving. Susie Jr. had instructed everyone around her mother to keep things upbeat. There were things that her mother was unaware of that had to be kept from her, and which Susie Jr. monitored the fax machine to make sure her mother didn't see. Susie didn't know that Larry Tisch had died of cancer, or that Bill Ruane had called Warren to say that he had been diagnosed with lung cancer. Ruane was doing chemo at Sloan Kettering, where Susie had gotten her second opinion. Warren got tears in his eyes every time Ruane's name was mentioned. The combination of this and Susie was too much. He had some time ago abandoned the 1,000-calorie-a-day diet. Susie's weight has been quite stable for the past 2 weeks. We keep a chart of it. I eat a chocolate sundae. She eats a little bit of the chocolate sundae. And since my diet is naturally fattening, it helps her. I'm gaining weight, and she's stayed stable. She's in no danger of becoming anorexic. On New Year's Eve, Nancy Munger was throwing Charlie a big 80th birthday party. Buffett flew down to Los Angeles for the celebration. He desperately needed the distraction, though it obviously bothered him that he would be attending the party alone, just as it had bothered him to show up at the Buffett group meeting alone. He had ordered an oversized cardboard cutout of Benjamin Franklin for a stand-up routine satirizing Munger's fascination with Franklin. Buffett had to ship the cardboard cutout to California in advance. Although he obsessed about whether it would arrive on time, it did, and he put on a classic performance which included his singing, "What a Friend I Have in Charlie." Munger closed the festivities with a speech. He began by giving advice to the audience in the latest iteration of various commencement and other speeches he had given elsewhere. Charlie's friends and relatives and members of the Buffett group all had copies of these speeches, now collected into a book, Poor Charlie's Almanac. Munger's favorite construct was to invoke Carl Jacobi. Invert. Always invert. Turn a situation or problem upside down. Look at it backward. What's in it for the other guy? What happens if all our plans go wrong? Where don't we want to go, and how do you get there? Instead of looking for success, make a list of how to fail instead, through sloth, envy, resentment, self-pity, entitlement, all the mental habits of self-defeat. Avoid these qualities, and you will succeed. Tell me where I'm going to die, that is, so I don't go there. Munger's other favorite theorem accused every academic discipline, biology, physics, economics, psychology, and so forth, of developing certain useful models, then applying them indiscriminately, wearing blinders. He advocated a multidisciplinary model approach to avoid the proverbial man with a hammer syndrome, the man who thinks everything is a nail. Munger collected models and laid them out as useful tools for life. He had a devoted following who appreciated the way he sliced through the Gordian knot of difficult problems, often by saying the unspeakable. They found his synthesis enlightening. Some in this camp felt that Munger's genius was under-recognized because he was swallowed up in the showman Buffett's shadow. In recent years, however, Munger had become a more visible advocate for his views. He was always coming up with mind-boggling arcana as illustrations. Right now, he was fascinated with the lay magistrate system of England as a model for properly incentivizing ethical behavior, and various aspects of that system were invoked in his birthday speech. Munger wandered off on a brief detour to praise his wife for her many wonderful qualities, then returned to giving advice to the audience about the models of life that led to success and happiness. He seemed convinced, however, that he, and Buffett, now lived on some elevated plane. He invoked his independence and Buffett's as reasons for their success, but then said it would probably be unwise for others, including his own children, to try to emulate the two of them. Nancy Munger, who was standing next to Buffett, asked, "How do I get him to stop?" Charlie started going into his wind-up. "In the end," he said, "I'm like old Valiant for Truth in the Pilgrim's Progress, who said, 'My sword I leave to him who can wear it.'" Good Lord, thought some of the Buffett group members. Eventually, Nancy went out onto the stage and gently led Charlie away. Buffett went straight back from Charlie's party to San Francisco to see Susie, who had just finished her 12th treatment. The radiation schedule drew out his protective instincts. 4.5 weeks left. Martin Luther King Day is in January. Those radiology technicians, oh, believe me, they take every holiday there is. But anyway, I would say so far so good. They're saying that this week is when it starts hitting her hard, but it hasn't hit her hard yet. She drinks what she calls this motor oil, and that's protecting her throat. Nonetheless, Susie was spending most of her time in bed. It's just amazing how little she is up. She's either asleep, or getting ready to go to sleep, or getting up from being asleep. I would say 17 or so hours out of 24. We make it a point, no matter what. We walk for 6 blocks or so every day. The rest of the time, I just hold her, basically. The man who had always been on the receiving end was now learning to give. Rather than being taken care of by his wife, he was taking care of her. Buffett, of course, had not become some other person, but by acting out his values, loyalty, stewardship, he seemed, in his own way, to have incorporated some of the lessons of Susie's life into his own. Chapter 60. Frozen Coke. Omaha and Wilmington, Delaware. Spring 2004. Toward the end of her radiation, Susie's mouth was so burned and dry that some days she could not eat or drink. The doctors put her back on the feeding tube because her throat was choked with a thick, dry mucus. She spent most of the time sleeping. But every day she and her daughter, or Kathleen, walked a few blocks on Sacramento Street. As spring stole over San Francisco, Susie stayed bundled in a coat, gloves, scarf, and earmuffs to stay warm. She hated to be alone. "Can't you just sit on the couch and look at magazines while I'm awake?" she asked Susie Jr. Then she scribbled WHT, her father's initials, on a piece of paper, a wry reference to the family trait of becoming anxious when alone. She was cared for by her nurses, Kathleen, her daughter, and John McCabe, her former tennis coach, who after many years of looking after her once they had both moved to San Francisco, was well-schooled and acting in a 100% supportive role. Anyone else, however, was likely to trigger her giving impulses and to drain her of energy. On the weekends, when Warren came, he sat with Susie in the TV room watching old episodes of Frasier, or simply hung around in his bathrobe reading the paper. Susie was comfortable with him there. He made her feel secure. But decades of her giving and his receiving didn't disappear overnight. Sometimes Susie was so sick from the radiation that even Warren had to leave. But he was doing his best to immerse himself in the day-to-day needs of his family in a way that he had never done before. To give his daughter a break from endless days in Susie's apartment, Warren would take her to Johnny Rockets for a burger. The rest of the time he spent with Sharon. He had even gotten involved in the minutia of Susie's radiation treatment, however. Her taste buds aren't gone yet. I talked to the radiation oncologist, and it's conceivable that some of the tongue won't get hit by what they're doing, which could presumably mean a fair number of taste buds would stick around. Warren Buffett, the man who ducked the subject of a common cold and used terms like not feeling up to par as euphemisms for illness, the man who changed the subject uneasily whenever anyone spoke of physical complaints, and who professed ignorance of the most basic points of anatomy, was using terms like radiation oncologist and doing medical homework for his wife. But as he grew more optimistic about Susie's recovery, he started to become more irritable and needy. The business events of the year 2004 began to consume him in between the trips he made back and forth to San Francisco every weekend. Unlike the ascending journey to glory of 2003, this would be a very different kind of year. Moreover, in early 2004, he was deprived of his regular source of support. Sharon Osbourg had gone on a lengthy trip to Antarctica with his sister Bertie. On a ship cutting through the ice, she was reachable only by occasional emails. He filled the hours by scribbling away at his letter to shareholders, emailing it back and forth to Carol Loomis, and by serving as teacher and unpaid father confessor to corporate America. He had become the elder statesman of the business world. Buffett always said, "Be long-term greedy, not short-term greedy." People turned to him because they trusted his direct way of getting to the heart of things and his sense of right and wrong. Although rich beyond even his own wildest dreams, he had passed up a lot of opportunities to make more money or to make it faster. This had brought him power and respect of a different sort. He was not feared like so many businessmen. He was admired. Prominent people made the pilgrimage to Omaha or sought him out at events to ask for his influence and help. Sports figures like Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Cal Ripken Jr., and Alex Rodriguez came for advice. Bill Clinton stopped by for lunch to get advice on fundraising for his new charity. Buffett was also pals with Mike Bloomberg, got along with John McCain, and maintained a good relationship with the senior Bushes and other Republicans like Chris Shays. He endorsed Senator John Kerry for president, but Kerry was not the candidate, and unlike the entertaining triumph of the Schwarzenegger campaign for governor of California, Schwarzenegger most definitely was the candidate, Buffett found himself associated with a respected senator who had no charisma. The less-than-electrifying Kerry campaign meant that Buffett focused far more on his business relationships during 2004. CEOs like Jeffrey Immelt of General Electric, Anne Mulcahy of Xerox, and Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan showed up in Omaha to pick his brain. The internet search firm Google was going public that summer, and its co-founders, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, were stopping in to see him because they admired his shareholder letters. The previous fall, after her indictment for lying to the government in connection with allegations of insider trading, for which she was never charged, Martha Stewart and her CEO, Sharon Patrick, had come out to Omaha to visit him. Buffett bought Stewart and Patrick a steak dinner, but couldn't solve Stewart's legal problems. The environment for prosecution of white-collar fraud was changing rapidly, partly because there was just so much white-collar fraud to prosecute these days. New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, who had launched a merciless attack on corruption in business and on Wall Street, now led the SEC and the Department of Justice in a three-legged race to see which agency could prosecute most zealously. The others hopped along desperately trying to keep up with Spitzer's pace. All their charges got bundled into one trial or settlement in the end. Spitzer was diabolically inventive at using the new electronic tools of the Internet, especially email, as evidence, at harnessing an accommodating press as a weapon, and at wielding an arcane New York statute, the Martin Act, that gave him virtually unlimited powers, checked only by his personal, and virtually non-existent, sense of prosecutorial discretion. With these tools, he had forced two prominent CEOs to resign, Buffett's business colleague Hank Greenberg, who was now the former CEO of AIG, and his son Jeffrey Greenberg, the former CEO of insurance broker Marsh & McLennan. A pall of fear hung over corporate America. Spitzer was so successful at execution by media that the bitter joke had become that he was saving the government the cost of indictment and trial. Juries that formerly treated white-collar malefactors with deference were now routinely sending them to prison like any other criminal. Under new mandatory sentencing guidelines, judges were imposing harsh sentences on them. Some of this mayhem was well-deserved. Greed, hubris, and lack of enforcement had given many people in business the impression that the rules did not apply to them. Just as stock options and the Internet bubble had engorged the senior echelons of businesses' wallets at an exponential speed, so had the backlash arrived in gargantuan proportions. Buffett, like most of corporate America, had not fully adjusted to this new environment. His view of proportion was shaped by the earlier era, defined by the careful prosecutorial calibrations of former SEC enforcement chief Stanley Sporkin and U.S. Attorney Otto Obermeyer, by the travails of Solomon, when even Paul Moser, who nearly brought down the whole financial system after Gutfreund failed to report his crime, had only served 4 months in prison. His viewpoint would eventually be revised, however, by the outcome of events that had occurred at Berkshire Hathaway itself. Buffett usually arrived at the airport to pick up his guests personally. He took them on a nerve-wracking ride to the office, if, that is, they were not too dazzled by him to notice, spent a couple of hours listening to their issues and throwing out ideas, then usually escorted them to Garratt's and treated them to a T-bone and hash brown meal. He told them to be plain-spoken with shareholders in annual reports, to pay employees in alignment with shareholders, not to run their business according to the whims of Wall Street analysts, to deal with problems forthrightly, not to engage in accounting shenanigans, and to choose good pension plan advisors. Sometimes people asked how to manage their own money, but while he gave them some basic ideas, he didn't hand out stock tips. To all those who felt the life of a CEO under scrutiny was not what it used to be, Buffett talked about the 98th floor in terms a CEO could understand. People who were looking down from the top at everybody else had to keep things in perspective. So what if they got knocked down a few pegs or lost some of their money? Those who still had their family, their health, and a chance to do something useful for the world should try to count their blessings, not their curses. If you go from the first floor to the 100th floor of a building, and then go back to the 98th, you'll feel worse than if you'd just gone from the first to the second, you know? But you've got to fight that feeling, because you're still on the 98th floor. He considered himself on the 100th floor most of the time. However, during the spring, 2004 was definitely shaping up to be a 98th floor kind of year. He waited with impatience as Susie suffered through her radiation, until the moment later in the spring when her doctors would perform an MRI to determine whether the treatment had knocked out the cancer cells. Business was also problematic on various fronts. Buffett felt that he had struck out when it came to bringing home the ginger snaps, new acquisitions and new stocks to buy. Berkshire had around $40 billion in cash or the equivalent, which was not a happy position. Most of the companies within Berkshire Hathaway were doing well. Even the beleaguered General Re had finally but truly reversed course and posted an underwriting profit in 2003. But GEICO had just emerged from a bitter price war and was locked in a battle for customers with its arch-rival, Progressive. GEICO had run a commercial in 1999 featuring a popular new character, the GEICO Gecko. But GEICO's internet presence was lagging behind Progressive's webpage, which let customers comparison shop. Buffett had been thinking about the internet and auto insurance for a decade now. He went to meetings at the company's headquarters near Washington and repeated one statement over and over: "He who wins the internet wins the war." He waited impatiently for the internet business to reach its potential. Berkshire had appointed a new board member, Charlotte Guyman, a former Microsoft executive. The board now had its first woman, who also lowered the average age. Buffett said, however, that he did not seek board members for their demographics. He wanted owner-oriented, business-savvy, interested, and truly independent board members. Now Buffett sent Sharon Osbourg and Guyman to Washington to help GEICO speed up its website improvement. "I have total confidence in GEICO," he said, all the while invoking his new internet mantra, "He who wins the internet wins the war." Buffett paid more attention to GEICO than almost any other business he owned, simply because he loved it. He was also a great fan of both Tony Nicely and his co-CEO, Lou Simpson, whose investing track record he now trumpeted to shareholders in his annual newsletter for the first time. For the past 25 years, Simpson had averaged 20.3%, beating the market by an average of 6.8% a year. The stocks he bought were different from Buffett's, but the method was the same, and his record was almost as good as Buffett's own. Now it was obvious why Buffett granted him so much autonomy and paid him so well. Simpson qualified as another of the super-investors of Graham and Doddsville. Admittedly, however, as competition increased, the super-investor's job was getting harder all the time. Still, the challenge of finding new investments wasn't nearly as severe as bird-dogging the ones that Berkshire already had. Coca-Cola was again evolving into a nightmarish preoccupation. Since the death of Goizueta, quarter by quarter, month by month, its business had grown steadily worse. New evidence of accounting manipulation appeared like barnacles on Coca-Cola's earnings. The stock had sunk below $50 from a high in the $80. In percentage terms, it was hovering somewhere around the 60th floor. Doug Daft had earned a reputation for volatile moods and Byzantine politicking. A number of senior members of management had departed during his tenure. His subtle tweaking of the four main Coke brands had produced unspectacular results, along with column after column of copy meowing at inept ads. Pepsi had pulled off a huge success with Gatorade after Coca-Cola failed to make that deal with Quaker Oats back in 2000. Then, a whistleblower declared that Coca-Cola rigged a marketing test for a fountain product called Frozen Coke to impress a longtime customer, Burger King. The whistleblower had also accused Coke of accounting fraud, and the SEC, the FBI, and the U.S. Attorney's Office started investigating. The company's stock price shrank to $43. Buffett had had enough of the managed earnings that underlay these problems, in which the Wall Street analysts' predictions of what a company would earn enticed managers to dig behind the sofa cushions in order to make the numbers, thereby meeting or beating consensus expectations to please investors. Because the vast majority of companies had tried to set, then surpass, Wall Street's expectations instead of simply reporting what they had earned, making the practice uniform, even a penny-per-share shortfall made them look as though they were having problems and often led to precipitous declines in stock prices. Thus, companies claimed they must manage earnings in a vicious, self-fulfilling game. But earnings management was a sort of Ponzi-ing. If carried on long enough, a petty form of cheating snowballed into larceny. "I can't tell you how much I hate managed earnings in terms of what they do to people. The nature of managed earnings is that you start out small. It's like stealing $5 from the cash register and promising yourself you'll pay it back. You never do. You end up the next time stealing $10. Once you start that kind of game, it draws everybody in. The organization picks up on it. People get cute and clever, and it snowballs. I gave these speeches after we discovered it. I told them, now the monkey's off our back. We don't have to predict anything to the analysts. Let's just give the damn handout showing the results every year, and whatever we earn, we earn.
Buffett wanted out of the game. If asked off the record what his worst business mistake was, he no longer listed sins of omission. Instead, he said, serving on boards. He was weary most of all of the way it tied his hands. Coca-Cola had changed its policy of requiring directors to retire at age 74 to one that merely required directors at that age to submit a letter of resignation for the board to consider. Leaving the Coke board would have let him tap dance off into the sunset. But for the savior of Solomon, to snub a company in trouble would be like sticking a dagger in the stock. I wouldn't stay on the board, except I don't feel like leaving the other guys to deal with the mess at Coca-Cola, Buffett said. His pro forma letter was, of course, rejected. This was seen externally as a power play to maintain the coziness of a board of cronies. Buffett had no idea what a plateful of misery he had just ordered. As soon as the proxy statement was filed with Buffett's name listed for election as a director, Institutional Shareholder Services, a powerful organization that consulted on shareholder voting and voted proxies on behalf of institutional investors, told its clients to withhold their votes for him. ISS said that Buffett's independence as a member of the audit committee could be affected by the fact that Berkshire Hathaway companies like Dairy Queen and McLane bought $102 million of Coca-Cola products. At a time when scandals involving conflicts of interest had shaken confidence in institutions ranging from the church to the military, the government, and business and nonprofit organizations, accusations of conflicts of interest and questions of governance were taken with a new seriousness. The cronyism of Coca-Cola's board could have been attacked on other grounds, but ISS lacked any sense of proportion in applying its principles regarding conflict of interest. Its lack of proportion was in keeping with the lack of proportion shown by most who were attacking business at the time, which, to be fair, some in the business world had more than earned, but nonetheless, disproportionate it was. Since Berkshire's purchases of Coke for its businesses were trivial when compared to Berkshire's ownership stake in Coke, which was huge, how could Buffett's behavior as a member of the audit committee or the board of Coca-Cola be said to be compromised? The rules of ISS, however, were based on a checklist with no leeway whatsoever for common sense. CalPERS, the powerful California Public Employees Retirement System, also decided to withhold support for half of Coke's directors, among them Buffett, in his case because the audit committee on which he sat had approved the auditors to do non-audit work. While CalPERS was taking a principled stance on auditors, this recommendation was sort of like putting out the candles on a birthday cake with a fire extinguisher. Buffett made a quasi-joke of it in public, saying that he was paying CalPERS and ISS to rally votes against him as an excuse to get off the board. But in fact, he was mad, especially at ISS. It seemed obvious to him that the billions of dollars worth of Coca-Cola stock that Berkshire owned grossly outweighed the Coke products that Berkshire Hathaway bought. If I were a wino off the street, those amounts they're talking about might be significant. But I own 8% of Coca-Cola. We've got so many more dollars in Coke than anything else. How could I possibly favor Dairy Queen's interests over Coke's when I own so much more of Coke's stock? Herbert Allen sent an emotional letter to the Wall Street Journal, citing the Salem witch trials when reasonably stupid people accused reasonably smart and gifted people of being witches and casting spells. Then they burned them. Up until the geniuses at ISS said it, nobody knew that Warren was really a witch. When corporate board members were surveyed, they unanimously thought Buffett was their dream director. We would come and wash Buffett's car to have him on our board. There's not a person in the world who wouldn't take him on their board. CalPERS' action shows the stupidity of corporate governance run amok, analogous to an NFL coach preferring an unknown quarterback from a Division II college instead of a Super Bowl quarterback. If you were a shareholder, given the choice to have Warren Buffett on that board or not, you'd want him.
The Financial Times referred to ISS as the Darth Vader of corporate governance, citing a position that smacked of dogma. With inkwells of backlash spilling all over them, CalPERS and ISS began to look foolish, somewhere between hideous and self-promoting populists, as one retired CEO put it on the survey. How could you bring yourself to a position where you would vote against him as a director and think that was a pro-shareholder thing to do? What a ridiculous piece of advice. Throwing Buffett off the board to improve the audit committee was like firing your doctor because you were still sick. What Coca-Cola needed was more Buffett, not less. ISS responded by saying that it was not advocating a vote against Buffett. Rather, it was saying to withhold votes from him because of his position on the audit committee. But withholding a vote was not voting for Buffett, no matter how you parsed the words or why you said you did it. The more ISS explained, the less anyone was convinced. The bigger problem was that ISS was not just giving advice. Because so many investors had simply delegated their voting rights to it, ISS was more like a single behemoth shareholder that controlled as much as 20% of all the board votes for major corporations in the United States. The securities laws had not anticipated that a situation could arise in which one unregulated, magisterial shareholder held so much power over American businesses. But there it was. Buffett had a passionate view of corporate board responsibilities, founded in his partnership and based on alignment of interests. I think owners should behave like owners, and I think they should care about independence. And so those guys are right on 2 out of 3. It's just that they don't have the faintest notion of what independence is about or how boards actually work. This checklist approach is totally crazy. If we'd gone out and found somebody in the unemployment line and paid them $125,000 to be a Coke director, they'd be considered independent. And CalPERS and ISS would have no problem voting for him, even though he depended completely for his income on that paycheck from Coke. Studies, however, had shown either no correlation or negative correlation between board independence and a firm's performance. But for the Koch board to rail against ISS also lacked a certain credibility and seemliness. Now that Koch's stock was barbecue, its board members could convincingly summon no more than low to middling dudgeon. The accusations of a crony board neared the mark. Although it had factions, one faction ruled, or rather misruled. Buffett admitted that he should have done more to try to steer things right at Coke. Indeed, if Coca-Cola had been run by him, assisted only by a six-pack of Cherry Coke, perhaps many of its woes could have been avoided. Instead, a brew of important people, several of them titanic personalities, and all of them accustomed to being in charge, could not sit back and simply allow themselves to be led by a weak CEO. They had spun into a vortex. The daft had improved Coca-Cola's profits, sales, and cash flows, and had mended poisonous relations with the bottlers, were not enough to turn things around for him. In February, Daft suddenly told the board he was resigning. Daft was unpopular in many quarters, but his announcement set off dismay at the prospect of more bad publicity for Coca-Cola. This time, the next guy in line could not be simply plugged into the job. Some board members viewed that as a chance to finally do the job right. In a move that had instantly attracted controversy, however, concurrent with the announcement of Daft's resignation, 77-year-old Don Keough had joined the board. Keough, who had been sometimes referred to as the shadow CEO, became chairman of the search committee. He and Buffett now spent hours on the phone trying to find a leader for Coca-Cola.